no wife, but he acquired what amounted to an adopted son. He brought René Jussomme's 13-year-old boy, Toussaint, under an indenture to St. Louis to raise and educate him. Eventually, Sacagawea's son, Jean-Baptiste, and daughter, Lisette, became boarders in Clark's home and were tutored there. Ensign Pryor carried Lewis's May 29th letter to Clark, with instructions to hand it over at the mouth of the Ohio, where Clark and party were expected in late June or early July. Pryor would provide a military escort up the Mississippi. Clark was traveling with two keelboats, bringing his household furniture and heavy equipment for the Indians, including a horsepower mill and blacksmith's tools. And, of course, his wife and his nieces. He had written Lewis that he would be arriving with goods and merchandise. In his letter to Clark, Lewis showed what a good humor he was in, writing in a jocular vein, "I must halt here in the middle of my communications and ask you if the matrimonial dictionary affords no term more appropriate than that of goods, alias merchandise, for that dear and interesting part of the creation? It is very well, General, I shall tell Madam of your want of gallantry, and the triumph, too, of detection will be more complete when it is recollected what a musty, fusty, rusty old bachelor I am." Lewis went on, "I trust you do not mean merely to tantalize us by the promise you have made of bringing with you some of your nieces. I have already flattered the community of St. Louis with this valuable acquisition to our female society." It turned out that Clark had brought only one niece, the beautiful and accomplished Miss Anderson, his sister's daughter. She caused a flutter in town. A friend wrote to Secretary Bates, "Great agitation in St. Louis among the bachelors. To prevent fatal consequences, a town meeting has been proposed for the purpose of disposing of her by lot." As had been the case on the expedition, Lewis went through periods of doing little or no writing, followed by periods of extensive composition. In the summer of 1808, he did a lot of writing, personal, chatty letters, sparkling with good humor, as well as his official documents. In a long letter of July 25th to his old army friend and fellow speculator in Kentucky lands, Major William Preston, Lewis gave a glimpse of his life and emotions. "How wretchedly you married men arrange the subjects of which you treat," Lewis complained in his opening. Preston had recently married Julia Hancock's older sister. Lewis said that, "Just because you have gained that which I have yet to obtain, a wife," Preston was not excused from starting off with an entire page about land speculation and your musty, frusty trade, "and a flimsy excuse about the want of money to enable you to come and see us, etc., etc., before you came to the point." The point was that she is off. She was Letitia Breckinridge, who on June 2nd had married Robert Gamble of Richmond. "So be it," a disappointed but resigned Lewis wrote. "May God be with her and hers, and the favored angels of heaven guard her bliss both here and hereafter," is the sincere prayer of her very sincere friend, to whom she has left the noble consolation of scratching his head and biting his nails, with ample leisure to ruminate on the chapter of accidents in matters of love and the folly of castle building. Lewis was generous about the man who had won his fair lady. "Gamble is a good-tempered, easy, honest fellow. I have known him from a boy. Both his means and his disposition well fit him for slumming away life with his fair one in the fashionable rounds of a large city." He was also charitable about Letitia. "Such is the life she has selected, and in its pursuit I wish she may meet all the pleasures of which it is susceptible." Lewis wanted his friend to come to St. Louis to participate in the boom. "In my opinion," he wrote, "Louisiana, and particularly the District of St. Louis, at this moment offers more advantages than any other portion of the United States to the honest adventurer who can command money or Negroes." He described the economy based on corn, shipped to New Orleans in the form of barrels of whiskey, wheat, lead, and furs. "Were I to dwell on the advantages of this country, I might fill a volume." There would never be a better time to take the plunge. "I will risk my existence that you will at some future period regret having chosen any other," Lewis wrote. "You have no time to lose. Lands are rising fast, but are yet very low." prices had doubled in a year. If Preston would sell his place in Kentucky, even if he got only half value for it, and bring your money or Negroes with you to this country, you might purchase a princely fortune. Lewis backed his boosting with his own money. I have purchased 7,440 arpents, a French unit of land measure. An arpent was the equivalent of about 0.85 acres, for $5,530, all of it in the St. Louis neighborhood and blessed with springs and sites for mills, and excellent soil and ample rain. As for the Indians, Lewis admitted that they had been exceedingly troublesome during the last winter and spring, but insisted that I have succeeded in managing those on the Mississippi. He added, however, that the Osage and others on the Missouri are yet in a threatening position. Still, he was confident that the steps he was about to take would soon reduce them to order. Lewis had indeed been extremely active on the Indian front, although to what extent the policies he had put into motion would bring the various nations to order remained to be seen. He had sent a veteran Indian agent, Nicholas Boylvin, accompanied by a military escort of 27 men, to bring in 2 Indians of the Sauk and Foxes accused of murder. And he had initiated drastic measures against one band of the Osage tribe called the Great Osages. He explained his actions in a July 1st letter to Secretary Dearborn, his first report as territorial governor to the administration. The Great Osages had cast off all allegiance to the United States, he wrote, and no longer acknowledged the authority of their former leader, Whitehair. According to Whitehair and other information Lewis had received, the Great Osage had taken some prisoners, stolen some horses, killed some cattle. They had plundered frontier inhabitants of their clothes and furniture and burned their homes. If the Great Osages wanted war, Lewis was ready. He held several councils with the Shawnees, Delawares, Kickapoos, Iowas, and others, telling them that they were at liberty to wage war against the Great Osages. He began preparations in St. Louis because war appears to me inevitable with these people. I have taken the last measures for peace, which have been merely laughed at by them as the repetition of an old song. The problem was that the Great Osages felt themselves independent of the government because they had a Spanish trader among them. Lewis had therefore suspended all trading licenses, which caused an uproar among the traders in St. Louis, until a sufficient force could be sent to establish permanent trading posts. He provided General Clark with an escort of 80 men to go up the Missouri to establish a fortification and trading post on the Osage River. This amounted to an expedition against the Great Osages. Lewis needed more men and asked for an authorization to pay recruits for the militia. He needed supplies and asked Dearborn to send him 500 muskets, 300 rifles, 120 swords, 60 pairs of pistols, and a ton of gunpowder. That should take care of the Spanish-influenced southern flank. The danger on the northern front, on the Missouri beyond the Mandans, came from the British. Lewis gave orders that they should be kept out of U.S. territory, but of course he had no power to enforce them. Indeed, he wasn't sure the War Department would approve. Dearborn had about lost all his patience with the young hero. From his point of view, Lewis was doing everything wrong. The United States was on the verge of war with Britain. The War Department was woefully unprepared. Here was Lewis opening up another front, demanding weapons and men, marching regular troops off to deal with some minor Indian problems that sounded like a squabble between the Little Osages and the Great Osages, fed by wild stories from Whitehair and some traders. Lewis had said not one word about returning Big White to his people, even though the commander-in-chief had ordered him to make this his top priority. And he had taken unauthorized actions without properly reporting. The first Dearborn had heard about Boylvin's expedition to bring back the murderers, in itself a very questionable piece of Indian policy, had come from an army officer reporting the requisition for men and supplies. In a July 2nd letter that crossed Lewis's letter to him, Dearborn set a policy. Except in cases of the most pressing emergency, detachments of the troops should not be made until approved by the President. The secretary closed with a complaint. No communication except some drafts for money has, for many months, been received from the executive of Louisiana. That was a stinging rebuke, and no doubt surprising to Lewis when he received it. So long had he been accustomed to making decisions without having to seek any approval beyond talking it over with Clark. A worse rebuke quickly followed. On July 17th, Jefferson wrote to Lewis. He opened with a complaint. "Since I parted with you in Albemarle in September last, I have never had a line from you." He said he would have written earlier, but for his conviction that something from you must be on its way to us. Those were stern words for Jefferson, and he immediately softened them. He realized that the slowness of the mails might have been the cause. He said it was not until February that he had learned that the Arikaras had attacked Ensign Pryor's expedition to return Big White to his people and turned it back with casualties, including the loss of George Shannon's leg. This was a severe blow to the president, who had given his word that Big White would be returned home safely and soon. As to his relations with Lewis, Jefferson had decided to put an end to this mutual silence and write himself to ask for a report from Lewis on what he intended to do to return Big White. "We consider the good faith and the reputation of the nation as pledged to accomplish this." He hastened to add he did not want any considerable military expedition sent up the river in the present uncertain state of our foreign concerns. But he did authorize Lewis to get the job done if it can be effected in any other way and at any reasonable expense. That statement from the president amounted to almost a blank check for Lewis, nearly as good as the letter of credit he had carried with him on the expedition, or so at least Governor Lewis chose to read it. Jefferson passed on some welcome news. "A powerful company is forming for taking up the Indian commerce on a large scale." It was headed by John Jacob Astor and would have a capital of $1 million. Jefferson described Astor as "a most excellent man, long engaged in the fur business and perfectly master of it." As to the bad news, relations with Britain were worse than ever, and the Congress was debating whether war will not be preferable to a longer continuance of the embargo. In politics, it looked as if the Republican nominee, Secretary of State James Madison, would easily defeat the Federalist Charles Pinckney. But with this question, it is my duty not to intermeddle. Lewis's friends and family in Albemarle were fine. Jefferson's closing line cut to the heart. "We have no tidings yet of the forwardness of your printer. I hope the first part will not be delayed much longer." The journals were in St. Louis, and Lewis had not prepared a single line for the printer, who was in Philadelphia. Jefferson here offered him an opportunity to straighten out his misconception, but Lewis did not take it. He never answered the letter. Nor did he reply to others. In August, Jefferson told Dearborn, "It is astonishing we get not one word from him." The cause, almost surely, was Lewis's chagrin at failing to prepare his manuscript for the printer. He knew how much it meant to Jefferson. He further knew how much it meant to his own financial future and to his reputation. Yet he did nothing. Clark must have talked to him about publication. Still, he did nothing. True, he was terribly busy, but he had an option. A man who could put more than $5,000 into land speculation could afford a $500 per year editor. Not that an editor could have done the job quickly or accurately, at least without Lewis's active help, but hiring one would have meant some progress was being made. In addition, Lewis might have told Jefferson that it was impossible for the governor of Louisiana to find time to do the work himself. Had Lewis pointed this out and confessed to Jefferson that nothing had been done, the president could have helped, perhaps by getting the journals to Washington and putting some War Department clerks to work on them. Jefferson must bear some of the responsibility. He could have pushed Lewis much harder. Dumas Malone comments that, in this case, Jefferson, who was so tolerant of persons he trusted, may have erred on the side of patience. Lewis found numerous opportunities to get out of the office, sometimes on horseback trips for land speculation, on other occasions to visit old army friends at Bellefontaine. He visited George Shannon in the hospital. He joined other Masons in St. Louis in establishing a Masonic lodge in St. Louis and agreed to serve as the first master. He helped establish the first newspaper west of the Mississippi by participating in the financing of Joseph Charles's Missouri Gazette, which printed its initial issue on July 22, 1808. The governor used it as an outlet for his pronouncements. On August 2, the paper printed the first half of Lewis's long policy statement to Dearborn. He used the nom de plume, Clatsop. He also wrote occasional pieces for the newspaper. On November 16, 1808, he contributed an essay on The True Ambitions of an Honest Mind. It read in full, "Were I to describe the blessings I desire in life, I would be happy in a few but faithful friends. Might I choose my talent, it should rather be good than learning. I would consult in the choice of my house convenience rather than state, and for my circumstances desire a moderate but independent fortune. Business enough to secure me from indolence, and leisure enough always to have an hour to spare. I would have no master, and I desire few servants. I would not be led away by ambition, nor perplexed with disputes. I would enjoy the blessings of health, but rather be beholden for it to a regular life and an easy mind than to the school of Hippocrates. As to my passions, since we cannot be wholly divested of them, I would hate only those whose manners rendered them odious, and love only where I knew I ought. Thus would I pass cheerfully through that portion of my life which cannot last always, and with resignation wait for that which will last forever." These are ideals that Polonius would have approved, put in the stilted language the earnest young governor often used when he tried to express feeling. Some of the blessings he described he enjoyed, others not. He had a few faithful friends, most of all Jefferson and Clark. He lived in fairly simple accommodations. He was short of an independent fortune, but inside of one. He often complained about his lack of leisure. He had but one servant, a free black man named John Pernier. His ambition was always in danger of leading him away, and he was cursed with disputes aplenty. His health was dependent on the medicines for malaria he regularly took. As to hatred, he perhaps had Bates in mind when he expressed the hope that he would hate only those who were odious. "My life is still one continued press of business which scarcely allows me leisure to write to you," Lewis told his mother in a letter of December 1, 1808. Of course, he was not quite that busy, but that is the way a young man opens a letter to his mother when he suddenly realizes he has not seen her or written to her in over a year. Lewis's first concern was for her health, but he expressed it with a complaint. "I sincerely hope you are all well, though it seems I shall not know whether you are dead or alive until I visit you again." With what can only be called a piece of gall from someone who had not written a letter to his family in a year, he went on, "What is John Marks and Edmund Anderson about that they do not write to me?" He wanted to know whether John Marks was studying in Philadelphia, whether Mary was married, and if so, if she had moved to Georgia. "I know your feelings on this subject," he continued. "I hope you will bear the separation with your usual fortitude." Then he expressed a fantasy of his, one that he had not put into his Missouri Gazette article, but nevertheless a blessing of great importance to him, to bring his family together in St. Louis. He already had Reuben with him. Now he told his mother that it was his hope that "I shall have it in my power in the course of a few years to bring you together again." He explained that he would be offering John Marks such inducements as will determine him to remove to Louisiana, and that he had selected a 1,000-acre farm for his mother, "with which I am convinced you will be pleased," and was purchasing other land so that Mary and her husband could join them. He said he had paid out $3,000 for the land, with $1,500 more due in May 1809, and $1,200 on May 1, 1810. To get the money, he was putting his inheritance, the farm on Ivy Creek, up for sale. He closed with a promise to come to Virginia for a visit during the course of the winter. Through the second half of 1808, Lewis was involved in organizing the St. Louis Missouri River Fur Company. Among the partners were William Clark, Manuel Lisa, Pierre Chouteau, Auguste Chouteau, General Wilkinson's brother Benjamin, and Reuben Lewis. Meriwether Lewis was assumed to be a secret partner. Not many details are known, but the general idea was to send a privately raised, publicly financed, very large expedition up the Missouri in 1809 to return Big White to his people. After the expedition got to the Mandan villages, the fur traders could go on to the mouth of the Yellowstone, where the company would enjoy a monopoly granted by Governor Lewis. The scheme smacked of nepotism and reeked of conflict of interest, but to Lewis and the partners it made perfect sense. The government could not raise the force necessary to overpower the Arikaras and the Sioux. The partners had insufficient capital to finance the military part of such an expedition. The commander-in-chief had authorized Lewis to use whatever means seemed best to him, at whatever reasonable cost, to return Big White. The work of forming the company went forward. In late July, Boylvin returned with four Indians. They were Iowas, and according to the Sauks and the Foxes, they were the men who had committed the murder. Lewis said publicly that three of them would be hanged after trial. The trial was held on July 23rd. "The streets of St. Louis teemed with Indian warriors," an observer reported. They incessantly harassed Governor Lewis and General Clark, beseeching pardon. The Iowa warriors were found guilty, but something must have bothered Lewis about the trial, for he ordered a new one, which was held on August 3rd. The Indians were again found guilty, but instead of hanging them, Lewis had them put in jail, evidently to await instructions.